new world. A better world than has ever been seen. A kingdom of conscience. Peace instead of war. Love instead of hate. That is what lies at the end of Crusade. Defend Jerusalem. That is your oath.
Obviously a very romanticized vision of the Crusades. Recent film, 2005 film called The Kingdom of Heaven. You got to do something to make it interesting for the silver screen, but the Crusades themselves are very interesting, if only in their historical aspects. But how much of what we think we know about the Crusades is actually true and historical? Dr. Thomas Madden is our guest, joining us for the remainder of this hour. He's professor of history at St. Louis University and author of several books, including The New Concise History of the Crusades. Dr. Madden, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
What's the biggest myth about this period of history that we call the Crusades?
Wow, it's hard. There are so many myths. I would say probably the most prevalent one is that the Crusades were a kind of a Christian holy war, a kind of a Christian jihad that was waged in the Middle East in order to conquer Muslim lands and then convert them, thereby expanding Christianity by the sword. And the truth is that that had nothing at all to do with the reasons why the Crusades were called or the motivations of any of the Crusaders. Conversion was not part of the reason the Crusades existed in the first place. The Crusades were called directly as a result of, ultimately as a result of centuries of Muslim conquests of Christian territories. The recent trigger was the conquest of all of Asia Minor, what is today Turkey, that was conquered in the years after 1071, after the Battle of Manzikert. And the Christians in the East, the Byzantine Empire, contacted the last Christians left who were free in the world, and that was the Christians in Western Europe, contacted the Pope and asked for their assistance, asked for them to send troops to help them to take back Asia Minor from the Turks. And that's really what started the First Crusade, which was called in 1095. The Pope gave the knights the mission of restoring to the Christians in the East what had been taken from them. And then he also enjoined them that if it was possible, after they had done that, to continue on to other lands that had earlier been taken by Muslims from Christians, in fact, even all the way to the Holy Land if that were possible. And as it turned out, they were very, very successful, and they made it all the way to the Holy Land.
I guess that was my other question, really, was even though we're talking about a broad swath of history there, with only 30 seconds before we take our first break, were the Crusades just given the goals that were set out from their inception, were they successful? Were they did they accomplish what they set out to do?
The First Crusade was successful. The rest of the Crusades were ranged anywhere from being failures to being mildly successful. In the big swath of history, their main success was in slowing the growth of Islam, slowing the growth of Islamic conquests. And probably that was pretty important because centuries later, the Islamic empires came very close to conquering all of Western Europe.
We're talking with Dr. Thomas Madden, professor of history at St. Louis University, about the Crusades. When we come back, the last half hour of the program we'll spend with him going into some more myths about the Crusades and clearing them up. He's author of several books, including The New Concise History of the Crusades. So these were not Christian versions of jihad. They were not imperialism per se. Some people paint a picture of the Crusaders as, well, basically mercenaries wearing crosses. Was this true? We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The tragedy of Terri Schiavo touched the hearts of so many. Her struggle reminded us all that we can no longer trust our hospitals and courts to provide food and fluids to incapacitated patients. The reality is that patients are denied medical treatment on a regular basis. But you can help protect yourself and your loved ones today by filling out a will to live. Download a will to live for your state at www.nrlc.org. This has been a perspective on life from National Right to Life.
The days in Genesis. Why such a battle?
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Bible Upholding Ministry of Answers in Genesis.
You know, many Christian leaders today declare that the length of the days of creation don't matter. They say, we shouldn't divide over whether they were six literal days or not. But after more than 30 years of ministry, I found the major reason most Christian leaders don't believe in six literal days of creation has nothing to do with what the Bible actually states. It has everything to do with their belief in millions of years. But the Bible gives us a fairly strict chronology from Adam to Christ. That's what all those begats are about. Now, if you accept the teaching of millions of years and try to put them into the Bible, well, this can't fit in the Bible's genealogies. The only place to try to fit long ages is in the 6 days of creation, and that's the ultimate reason many Christians don't believe in six literal days. And you know, by doing this, a person is really reinterpreting the clear teaching of Scripture and imposing man's fallible dates on God's Word. This means that man is in authority over God's Word, but God's Word should stand alone.
What kind of light can the Bible shed on so-called dinosaur mysteries? Ken Ham provides answers in a great booklet entitled, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? As we close out this week, here's your last opportunity to request 10 of the booklets for a gift of any amount. Call toll-free 1-888-89-ANSWERS. That's 888-89-ANSWERS, or on the web, answersoffer.org.
Okay, so what have you heard about the Crusades? People talk about them. We'll hear this now discussed often in the popular media as though, you know, everybody knows what happened here. This was really Christian aggression against the peaceful Muslim lands. Well, we've already demonstrated that that is not true, but there are other myths that persist about the Crusades, one of them being that we're really talking about a bunch of soldiers of fortune who decided to simply patch on a cross to their gear or to their shield and head off in seek of booty and plunder. We'll answer that one here in just a few minutes as we talk with Dr. Thomas Madden about the Crusades. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. live this Thursday, the 31st of July. Our call-in number 1-877-623-MYIE, and our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. What about this notion, Dr. Madden, that we're talking here about soldiers of fortune or mercenaries who are simply seeking to enrich themselves through what they could perceive to be kind of lucrative war-making, and a crusade was a good excuse?
Yeah, that's actually a myth that historians themselves perpetrated for a long time, really up until, really up and through the 1960s and 1970s, that was widely believed by even professional historians, that the ultimate impetus behind the Crusades was not religious or as a act of charity for Christians in the East, but rather that it was really to spread out, to go and conquer lands far away, because the argument was that there was not that many lands in Europe anymore, and to get rid of militant knights, because there were too many of them. They were always killing each other in Europe. And so the Pope thought up this idea of having them all go far away, kill the enemies of the faith, and then they could settle there and create sort of colonies. In fact, you see this in the recent movie, Kingdom of Heaven. Much of it is about that, about how you can start over in Palestine, and there you can set yourself up. In fact, the protagonist in the movie, played by Orlando Bloom, goes there and sets up his own kind of little plantation as though he were going to America. None of that, however, is true. We now know that booty and the actual settlement played very, very little role, if really a minuscule role, in the decision of individual crusaders to go. There's been a lot of work that's been done really since the 70s and 80s and 90s, primarily using new technologies with computers, where we've been able to now store, create really large databases from charter studies all over archives in Europe. And so we know much more about the Crusaders. And what we learned was that the Crusaders were not, they were not the poor of Europe. They were not the struggling sorts who were looking for lands. The people who went on crusade, particularly the leaders, the ones who bankrolled it, were themselves extremely powerful men, extremely wealthy men with large amounts of land already. Crusading was extremely expensive. The amount of money that it required to outfit yourself, to bring the horses, you had to bring all of your own, or at least buy all of your own provisions. You had to provide for your retainers. You were going to be away for years. So it was an enormous amount of money, and even wealthy men would go into debt or have to sell off a lot of their lands or other assets in order to do it. And on the flip side of this, the booty or land side of it, the fact is that crusades were notoriously bad for plunder. You could get some sometimes, although most of the time not. But whatever you did get was more than eaten up by your expenditures along the way, which, as I said, was very expensive. Even wealthy nobles would find themselves, by the time they got to Syria, out of money and having to scrape to make ends meet. So it was not a lucrative enterprise. And as far as the lands go, only a tiny percentage of crusaders ever decided to stay in the Holy Land, decide to stay in the Crusader East. 99%, more than 99% of them, once they went and did the job that they had signed up for, they would immediately come home. Because from their perspective, they had done what they wanted to do. They were doing this as an act of charity because they all were extremely, and this is the important point, that this was a religious campaign. They were extremely aware of the fact that they were sinful men who had done a lot of bad things. This is a warrior aristocracy. It made its living through killing. And these were men who knew that they had a very slim chance of getting into heaven. And the crusade provided a way for them to use what they knew how to do well, which is fight, and use it for a purpose which was good, which would actually be to the benefit of their soul, rather than to the detriment of it.
When they went to, I mean, not to be too simplistic about it, but when the Christians in the East called for the help of the Western European Christians and said, come help us get back what has been taken by Muslim conquest, it seems as though on the whole plunder issue, if you were going there to give people back what was originally belonging to them, in this case lands and cities and whatnot, you weren't carrying that off with you. You were putting it back into the hands of those that you were liberating.
Yeah, that's quite right, particularly with the First Crusade. All of the leaders on the First Crusade, when they went to the East, they all stopped at Constantinople, which was the capital of the Byzantine Empire, and they all met with the emperor there, and they all took oaths to the emperor that anything that they took, anything that they reconquered, would be restored to the Byzantine Empire. And at least initially, that's what they did. For example, one of their first targets was the city of Nicaea, where most people know it for the Council of Nicaea in 325, where the Nicene Creed was drafted. This city had been in Turkish control for quite some time, and the Crusaders were able to take the city, and it was given immediately back to the Byzantines. In fact, the Crusaders didn't even get to go into the city after it had fallen. It was just given immediately back to the Byzantine Christians. Now, by the time they got to Antioch, another one of the one of the original Christian patriarchates, by then they started to have a falling out with the Byzantines. And when the Crusaders actually took the city, there was some dispute over who it should actually go to, the emperor or to the Crusaders themselves. And that dispute would go on for quite some time. But as far as the individual crusader and what they got out of this, the rest of them, after Antioch was taken, almost all of them got on their horses and headed south toward Jerusalem.
There's this account of the Crusaders coming to Jerusalem in 1099 to retake the city, and the way some tell it, they killed everyone, man, woman, and child, and blood flowed in the streets like rivers.
Right. Whenever you hear about blood running in the streets like rivers, you can pretty well discount that. The phrase was commonly used in the Middle Ages. In fact, one monk who wrote about this actually refers to the knights making their way through the streets of Jerusalem, and the blood levels, the flowing blood levels, were so high they were up to the withers of the horses. It's just simply impossible. It would be difficult to fill a city with water up to that level, let alone blood. There aren't enough people around to bleed that much. The term itself is it's like when we say today, you know, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. We don't mean you're really making a mountain out of a molehill. It's a phrase. It's a turn of speech, and that's what this meant too. What they were trying to get across was that there was a fair amount of bloodshed when the city was taken, and that's true. Now, the idea that every man, woman, and child in the city was killed, we now know there's been a number of very close studies of this done, and we now know that's just simply not the case. There were a lot of particularly Jews who were allowed to be essentially ransomed off to relatives who got them, and then they went back to other nearby cities. So when the city eventually fell, there were attempts to try to work out how people would be able to leave or not leave, but then some of those deals fell through, and so there was some killing. You have to remember that in 1099, when Jerusalem fell, according to the standards of the time, both Christian and Muslim, when a city that was under siege refused to surrender, that meant that everything and everyone inside the city was forfeit to the conquering force if the city was taken by force. And that's what happened in Jerusalem. The Muslims had refused to surrender the city. They'd already expelled all the Christian inhabitants of the city. And so when the Crusaders took it, they basically entered a city that was all Muslim except for a few Jews that had decided to stay. So they didn't have a real concern with worrying about whether there were certain Christian enclaves still there. And therefore, during the mayhem of the conquering of the city, and Jerusalem is a difficult city to take. When the Romans took it, there was a lot of very deadly house-to-house fighting. It's a very tightly packed city. There was a fair amount of bloodshed after that. But as I said, many people survived. And as far as city conquests go, it ranks about similarly to other conquests at that time in that region.
Let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation for another 10 minutes with Dr. Thomas Madden, professor of history at St. Louis University and author of several books, including The New Concise History of the Crusades. You'll find several articles on the Crusades on the on-demand section of our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. What kind of questions or comments do you have on the Crusades? Call or email during this break, 1-877-623-MY-IE, or talk back at issuesetc.org, 1-877-623-MY-IE. If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely upon you to pay for the production, salaries, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. That's Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're interested in hanging around with a bunch of powerful men that further one another's careers, I guess you can meet Fred and Barney down at the Loyal Order of Water Buffalo. Stress is your problem, and those 40, 50 hours a week are killing you, and that cubicle's driving you nuts. Perhaps you should buy Joel Osteen's book and read it. If you're interested in Lutheran doctrine and practice and how we can spread that to our communities, check us out, Brothers of John the Steadfast, www.steadfastlutherans.com.
On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,500 who signed the online petition to bring Issues Etc. back, Wilma Dolbesh, Robert Donnell, Tyler Arnold, Eugene Colander, Brenda Shawcross, Pastor Richard Wolmer, Sharon Greening, Melissa DeGroot, James Windsor, and Steve Simon. Thanks for your support. Folks, if you're enjoying today's discussion on the Crusades, don't miss tomorrow's show. We're going to talk about the influence of Christianity on Western civilization. Dr. Alvin Schmidt will be our guest. Dr. Thomas Madden is our guest for the next 10 minutes. We're talking about the Crusades. We often hear about a children's crusade. I've heard some fanciful accounts of this. Children sent off to fight in the name of Christendom into Muslim lands. What's the real story on the so-called children's crusade?
Yeah, the funny thing about the Children's Crusade is that it was not made up of children, and it was not a crusade. The actual event occurred in 1212, and it was largely the result of a kind of a popular piety movement that had spread all around Europe at this time. This was a time when Jerusalem was no longer in Christian hands. It had been conquered back in 1187 by Saladin, and this bothered people in Europe a great deal. It's difficult for us today to really understand how much this affected everyone, from the lowest peasant to the highest king. The idea that God had punished them by giving Jerusalem away to the Muslims, and that this was a clear indictment of their own sinfulness. And crusade after crusade had failed to take Jerusalem back. So there was a popular piety movement at this time, which was in which the poor, it was thought that the holy poor, the poor of Christ, were the ones that were being called. And this kind of crystallized around a young man named Nicholas of Cologne, who said that God had told him to lead the poor to the Holy Land, and that if they would go there, then God would deliver it to them. He would deliver Jerusalem to them, because the nobles were all sinful and the like. The reason it was called the Children's Crusade is because the people who wrote about it, which were mostly monks and clerks and others who watched it all go by, they referred to them as the poor, but in the Latin they would be referred to as the pueri, which can be translated as the young people or the boys. And this was because it was common at the time to refer to the poor and the lower classes as boy, the way you might speak to a servant in previous years, boy. And this led many people to think that this was actually a crusade of children, but it wasn't. It was a crusade primarily of poor. Now, there were children involved in it that came with their parents. Lots of strange people went with it, beggars, bandits, all sorts. But they made their way ultimately down in this kind of mass movement. It was not a crusade. The Pope had not called it. But the few those that made it across the Alps got to various Italian cities, and they had been told that the Mediterranean was going to dry up for them so they could walk across. That didn't happen. The Pope at the time, Pope Innocent III, then he talked about how wonderful the zeal of these people was, but he pointed out that they were not crusaders, that this was not a crusade, and they should all go home. Those that could afford to then went home. A lot of others just ended up settling there in northern Italy.
Did Pope John Paul II apologize for the Crusades?
It's funny. People say that frequently, but the fact is that what he actually did, this was leading up to the Jubilee year in 2000, was that he apologized for the sins of Christians that occurred during the Crusades. But he was under pressure to apologize for the whole movement, and he didn't do so, and I think that's quite proper. The idea of the Crusades, as it was developed within canon law and within Christian thought, was completely in keeping with Christian theology or Catholic theology. And so it would be really almost impossible for a pope to ask for forgiveness for something like that, nor would I say his forgiveness is required. But I think it is quite proper to say that fallible humans went on crusade, and that many of them were sinful and did sinful things during it, and that's in fact what he said.
Well, related to that misperception of what John Paul II said with regard to the Crusades or the participants in the Crusades is kind of the flip side of that coin, and that is worldwide Muslims, many of whom, it is said, remember the Crusades vividly, are justified, therefore, in their hatred or their animosity or their fear of the West. Your thoughts there, Dr. Madden?
Yeah, this is one of the more interesting twists of history. The fact is that the Crusades are not... It is true that the Crusades are remembered in the Middle East now, particularly among Muslims, but it's not a memory that goes all the way back to the Crusades. When the Crusades were going on, Muslims at the time did not really know nor care very much about what they were. As far as they were concerned, this was just some infidels that were coming to fight them, and that after a while, they finally banded together and they defeated the infidels and threw them all out. Muslims and Muslim culture traditionally throughout the Middle Ages had very little interest in non-Muslim cultures. They were not interested in why Christians were doing what they were doing. For them, it was not important at all. And therefore, since the Crusades failed, and they continued to fail, from the Muslim perspective, they were completely irrelevant and not worthy of their consideration. So they didn't really know anything about them. You don't actually find out about the Crusades in the Muslim world really until the 19th century, when you start to have colonial powers, particularly the French, who saw the Crusades as kind of the precursor to French imperialism, brought then the story of the Crusade to their colonies in the Middle East, and there they began teaching them about the Crusades. So the odd thing about this is that the modern Middle Eastern view of the Crusades in the Muslim world is actually a view that was created by Europeans. It was one that was given to them in the 19th century and then has since been kind of dressed up in imperialism in a way that the Crusades never were in the Middle Ages.
Those who draw parallels between, to say nothing of whether or not any of these things are justified, but those who draw parallels between the war-making efforts of the United States or some other great world power in the West and the Crusades, is there any parallel to speak of there?
No, they're completely different things. A crusade was an act of devotion. It was done by individuals who took a vow to God. There was a ceremony that was done. And they took a vow to God to go and help his people and to try to restore lands that were consecrated to him back to him. And each crusader did that for the benefit of his soul, sometimes her. There were a few women who went. That's what drove them. There was no country, there was no colonial power, there was no organization. Crusades were never very well organized at all. They were done on an individual basis, and that may be one of the reasons why they didn't succeed very often. But in the motivation behind them, in their ultimate goal, and in their ultimate results, they really bear no similarity at all to modern warfare, which is waged by nation states.
And to someone who says, look, what Osama bin Laden masterminded on September 11th is really no different than what the Christians did to the Muslims during the period called the Crusades, with only about a minute here, how would you respond?
Well, they're quite different. I mean, the Crusaders were not terrorists. There were terrorists around at that time. They were called the Assassins. But they were not terrorists. They served notice as to what they wanted and why they were there and the wrongs that they believed that they were righting. And then they waged war in the acceptable way that war was waged at that time. So they were very familiar with terrorism because they lived it as well, and they considered it to be reprehensible too.
Would even the Muslims of that day have waged war according to the commonly held rules?
Yes, and they did. As I said, there were the Assassins, which were a sect that existed in the Middle Ages then, were essentially the medieval terrorists. They would go up to people and in crowds and stick knives into their back. They didn't have bombs, but they would use other methods. And they had suicide killers as well. And the Assassins would kill both Muslims and Christians. They had their own agenda, even though they were themselves Muslims. So on both sides, they would have considered that to be, again, reprehensible and very dishonorable, against God's law.
Dr. Thomas Madden is professor of history at St. Louis University, author of several books, including The New Concise History of the Crusades. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Alvin Schmidt will join us. We're going to expand the conversation about West versus East, or the Christian influence on the West, with him talking about Western civilization and the unmistakable fingerprints that one finds of Christian and Christendom and Christians in their vocations on Western civilization. Monday, we'll talk Mormonism with Bill McKeever. Yes, indeed, in a historical sense, their motivation was to somehow benefit their own soul by going forward into war. And, of course, this was may have done great good for the Christians. They were liberating insofar as they were successful. But no good for the soul. The soul is not benefited by the shedding of blood, except the shedding of blood of one, and that is Jesus Christ, our Savior, who laid down his life of his own accord, only to take it up again. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 1046, San Juan Capistrano, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.